smash up the Nord Stream pipeline and do that to their own allies. They're out of control. They're deluded.
Sure.
They're very dangerous. It is not a happy situation. And it looks to me that we could get something really nasty coming down. Because behind this, the Americans are aware now that they've lost control of the situation and that the dollar is going down.
Thank you very much. Well ended, Rodney Shakespeare, Professor of Economics from London. Glenn Diesel, thank you, Professor of International Relations at the University of Southeastern Norway from Oslo. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikael Vitale and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض و بَعْضَكُمْ فَوْقَ بَعْضٍ دَرَجَاتٍ لِيَبْلُوَكُمْ فِي مَا آتَاكُمْ إِنَّ رَبَّكَ سَرِيعُ الْعِقَابِ وَإِنَّهُ
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed, and He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Army and the paramilitary rapid support forces agreed to extend the ceasefire for 72 more hours as violence continues across the country. The Russian president says his country's drone industry could soon be worth over $12 billion once a plan to boost production is put into place. Also coming up, thousands of British railway workers will go on strike on May 13 after rejecting the latest pay offer by train companies. AM in Tehran, you're watching Press TV's World News. Thank you for joining us. Now, top story this hour, Sudan's army and the paramilitary rapid support forces have agreed to extend the ongoing ceasefire for 72 more hours as violence continues across the country. The Sudanese army had earlier given its initial approval to the extension, which was proposed by a regional African bloc. However, sporadic gunfire and airstrikes continued on the outskirts of the capital Khartoum and western Darfur region despite the truce, which was due to expire Thursday midnight. The U.S. has urged its citizens to leave the African country within 24 to 48 hours. The White House expressed concern on Wednesday over ceasefire violations, saying the situation would worsen at any moment. Several nations have already evacuated their citizens and diplomats from Sudan. More than 500 people have been killed and thousands injured since the fighting erupted in mid-April. The Hamas resistance movement has condemned the killing of a Palestinian man by Israeli forces over an alleged stabbing attack. The Gaza-based movement said the resistance will continue until the regime is defeated, Palestine is liberated, and all prisoners are freed. 39-year-old Ahmed Yaqub Taha was fatally shot near the occupied West Bank city of Salafit. Contrary to the regime's stabbing claim, videos posted online show he was brutally shot after getting out of his car. Since last year, Israeli forces have stepped up violence against Palestinians across the occupied territories. The regime's forces have killed at least 100 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank alone so far this year. A Palestinian official with the Islamic Jihad movement has warned Israel against assassination operations targeting resistance figures. The regime has repeatedly conducted raids into the occupied West Bank in recent months. We earlier discussed the issue in our news review program.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. A senior Islamic Jihad official says the Palestinian resistance movement has a deal with Lebanon's Hezbollah to coordinate in response to potential attempts by Israel to assassinate resistance leaders. Walid al-Qutati made the remarks in relation to reports that the Israeli regime has embarked on its assassination policy against Palestinian officials. He said the resistance takes the current dynamic employed by the regime seriously. Qutati said the Palestinian resistance remains integrated in confronting Israel. The Palestinian official said the resistance is not to give in. Israeli forces have conducted numerous raids into the occupied West Bank in recent months. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed so far this year. Khalid Barakat is a journalist and activist joining us from Ottawa, and we also have Mick Napier from the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign who joins us from Edinburgh. Welcome, gentlemen. Khalid Barakat, I'll first start with you. When you take a look at the way that the resistance groups are making this announcement, it's in reaction to how Israel has made it public that it's going to assassinate resistance leaders, something that in the past it wouldn't think of doing, to put that out in the public domain. Why do you think Israel has done that, and what has pushed Israel to the point where it's intimidated and hence has made this type of an announcement?
Yes, thank you so much for the invitation. Well, we have to remember that assassination policy is a constant policy in the Zionist regime. The Israelis have always practiced assassination. In fact, before even the establishment of the Zionist regime, their terrorist organizations, their criminal groups have killed international convoys, and some of those people who were involved in these crimes are actually later on to become prime ministers and foreign ministers of Israel. Let's also remember that in the 60s, the then prime minister of the Zionist regime, Golda Meir, have something very famous that Palestinians remember called Golda Meir list. And what is this list is about is the list of names of Palestinians, intellectuals, scientists, novelists, poets, any Palestinian who were creative worldwide, or strategist or scientist. 40 of them were assassinated and killed in assassination campaigns by Israel. So the experience of the Palestinian people and the Arab people with this regime is that they have always used assassination policy to serve their interests. They also killed Iraqi scientists, Iranian scientists, Egyptian scientists. And what Islamic Jihad and Hezbollah as leading forces of the resistance today, they understand that Israel also use assassination policy as a way out to solve its crisis. Although Israel understands that it can utilize these days this kind of policies in a war, a psychological war, event. And Hezbollah have especially a unique response and policy in terms of this. If we remember, for example, when Israel and the United States killed the leader of the Lebanese resistance, military resistance, Imad Mughniyeh, in Damascus, we saw the reaction of Hezbollah that Israel will pay a price. And it's still, until today, this is open, and Hezbollah keeps his options in terms of responding on the killing of Imad Mughniyeh and others.
Okay.
Let's just be one last sentence. Israel cannot carry assassination policies without the green light from Washington and the United States.
Well, the whole question here, Mick Napier, is why Israel is putting that out in the open. I mean, is that an open invitation that it's going to I mean, one scenario is that it's going to go through and it's going to assassinate a resistance leader. Does it want, is it inviting for a military engagement with these groups, in particular, of course, Hezbollah being now united with the resistance leaders on this issue? Because after all, if this does happen, this could spell also a huge security threat for Israel itself.
Well, the whole point of terrorism is to try to terrorize. And this is an example of announcing to the world that they intend to kill Palestinians anywhere in the world where they can find them and want to kill them. It also does double service because watch the US response. And there will be no US response which says, you cannot do this. They will find some form of words which allows Israel to do it. And also inside Israel itself, we're witnessing continuity from previous governments, but also something new. The continuity, of course, is the substantial rate of killing of Palestinians. But what's new is the style and the rhetoric which accompanies it. Previous Israeli regimes killed many thousands, but they tried to cover it up with honeyed words. This current government has created a base among the Israeli Jewish community which has a certain bloodlust. And really that bloodlust, the promises that were made to them for Ben-Gvir and Smotrich and Netanyahu to be re-elected and the other two to be elected, have to be paid back, and they pay it back in Palestinian blood. So it keeps their electoral base from deserting them for other elements. And as I say, it has to be paid in Palestinian lives. But it fits in, as our other guest has said eloquently, and he could have gone on for longer to talk about the terrible history of mass killings. But for Israel, their theory is very simple. They do not negotiate with the native people, with Palestinians, because they have a technological, military, and terror edge. And they can afford not to negotiate with the Palestinians because they can control them through their most advanced technology, which is, of course, enabled from America and the EU. So this real serious edge in delivering the means of violence has to constantly be renewed. And sometimes they are defeated. They were defeated in Lebanon in 2006. They were given a hiding by Hezbollah. They were not successful in their attempts to crush the Palestinian resistance in Gaza.
Sure. Thank you. Khaled Barakat, journalist and activist, Nick Napier, Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
Russia's drone industry could soon be worth 1 trillion rubles or over $12 billion once a plan to boost production is put into place. This is according to the Russian president.
A very important industry for the country to develop. Now my colleagues and I were just looking. I saw a drone figure. In the near future, the volume will become 500 billion rubles. But they immediately agreed with me that this is a very conservative estimate. Most likely, if we are all together, and the state too, we will work actively. It'll be a trillion rubles. It'll be such a volume.
Putin made the remarks after touring an industrial park in Moscow, which has been specially designed to manufacture drones. He added that drones could be used in virtually every part of the Russian economy. Last year, Putin ordered a strategy for drone development through 2030. The plan aims to increase Russia's drone output and create infrastructure for their widespread use in military and civilian sectors. According to Russian officials, the country should be able to make 18,000 drones a year by the end of 2026. Armenia has urged Russian peacekeepers to take full control over the only land route that links its territory to the Nagorno-Karabakh region.
Russian peacekeepers must keep the Lachin corridor under control and ensure the operation of the corridor. In other words, no one but the Russian Federation has the right to control the corridor. Azerbaijan should not impede the free movement in the corridor. That is what the trilateral statement of the November 9, 2020 provides for.
Pashinyan said by establishing a checkpoint on the Lachin-Buk corridor, Azerbaijan continues to escalate the situation in the region. The Armenian Prime Minister's comments came amid fresh tensions between Yerevan and Baku. Last weekend, Azerbaijan set up a checkpoint on the corridor, claiming that it wants to stop Armenia using it to transport weapons to Nagorno-Karabakh. Armenia says the checkpoint is a gross violation of Moscow-brokered agreements that ended the 2020 war between the two countries. There is apparently no let-up in the spate of industrial actions that have plagued the United Kingdom. This time, thousands of railway workers have announced their plan to go on strike on May 13. The National Union of Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers announced their decision after rail workers rejected the latest pay offer by train companies. The union said workers are left with no option but to continue their campaign for a negotiated settlement on pay, work conditions and job security. The train companies had offered a first year pay rise that is of 5% if the RMT guaranteed that no further strikes could take place. The UK has seen a wave of industrial actions across various public and private sectors since last summer, with workers demanding inflation-matching pay rises. The country's inflation has hit a 40-year high of about 10%. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of school teachers in England have walked off the job once again in a long-running dispute with the British government over pay and funding. The strike action this time comes after 3 weeks after members of the National Education Union that represents the teachers voted overwhelmingly to reject the government's offer that they said was insulting. Saeed Poreza reports from London.
On a normal day, they'd be in classrooms doing what they do best. But today, these teachers say, is time for action. After the nationwide February strikes, the government made a new pay offer to the teachers, which included a one-off payment of more than $1,200 this year and a 4.3% pay rise for most staff next year against a teacher's demand for a 9% rise. To the Minister of Education, Gillian Keegan, that was a fair and reasonable offer. To the teachers, who have seen a relative decline in their pay since 2010, it was an outrage.
Because we've had a pay freeze for loads of successive years since 2010, and then a few pay awards that were either below or in line with inflation, that's effectively another pay cut.
The government claims the rises will be covered by extra funding provided to state schools over the next 2 years.
The unions representing the teachers say this is not just about pay. As with other public sector disputes, they say it's about a lack of investment. It's about cuts to funding for schools, about teacher shortages.
Special education needs teacher Fiona Edwards recently told a special committee that gives recommendation to the government on teacher pay rises about how a lack of funding is impacting teacher recruitment.
I have 31 children with education, health and care plans, again, quite a bit above the national average. 11 of these children are in our autism unit. The autism unit ought to have 14 children, but at the moment we've only got 4 members of staff, not 5. We've been trying for a year to recruit a 5th member of staff, and until we do so, we can't have any more children in the unit.
The UK has been gripped by waves of public sector industrial action for months, brought on by double-digit inflation and a cost-of-living crisis. Despite the inconvenience caused by the strikes, public support for them remains strong.
I support it. I think the government should get back round the table and offer a decent pay increase so they can get back to work.
I think it's not surprising and absolutely inevitable, and I fully support the teachers.
And while the government twiddles its thumbs, there will be another strike on May the 2nd, once again keeping hundreds of thousands of teachers and students out of the classrooms. Saeed Poreza, London.
The Washington summit of U.S. President Joe Biden and South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol announced a strong commitment to expand the U.S.-Japan-South Korea trilateral alliance. However, in Seoul, these moves are seen by some as a subjugation of South Korea's national interests to the U.S. and Japan and generating tension on the Korean Peninsula. Pakistan's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif has managed to secure a vote of confidence from the country's parliament amid prevailing political turmoil over holding fresh elections in the country. Brings an end to world news for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
The world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
On Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it. and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
In the limelight.
The lead author of a new analysis shows that poverty in the U.S. silently killed 10 times as many people as all the homicides in 2019. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout wrote in this regard, a research published recently in the Journal of the American Medical Association estimated that poverty was linked to at least 183,000 deaths in the United States in 2019 among people aged 15 or older, making inadequate income the nation's fourth leading mortality driver that year behind heart disease, cancer, and smoking. Poverty kills as much as dementia, accidents, stroke, Alzheimer, and diabetes, said David Brady, a professor of public policy at the University of California, Riverside, and the lead author of the new analysis. Brady continued, "Poverty silently killed 10 times as many people as all the homicides in 2019, and yet homicide, firearms, and suicide get vastly more attention." Dr. William J. Barber, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, wrote recently that the research underlines the importance of connecting extremist inaction on gun violence to other forms of policy murder. The new analysis, co-authored by Ulrich Kohler of the University of Potsdam in Germany and Hoi Zheng of Ohio State University, stressed that the U.S. perennially has a far higher poverty rate than peer-rich democracies, which presents an enormous challenge to population health, given that considerable research demonstrates that being in poverty is bad for one's health. Poverty, which the study defined as less than half the median U.S. income, was associated with greater mortality than many far more visible causes in 2019, 10 times as many deaths as homicide, 4.7 times as many deaths as firearms, 3.9 times as many deaths as suicide, and 2.6 times as many deaths as drug overdose. The researchers argue their results indicate poverty should be considered a major risk factor for deaths in the U.S., which has seen life expectancy decline since 2015 and fall sharply amid the coronavirus pandemic. The researchers wrote, because the U.S. consistently has high poverty rates, these estimates can contribute to understanding why the U.S. has comparatively lower life expectancy, because certain ethnic and racial minority groups are far more likely to be in poverty, Our estimates can improve understanding of ethnic and racial inequalities in life expectancy. They continued, the mortality associated with poverty is also associated with enormous economic costs. Therefore, benefit-cost calculations of poverty-reducing social policies should incorporate the benefits of lower mortality. Moreover, poverty likely aggravated the mortality impact of COVID-19, which occurred after our analysis ended in 2019. Therefore, one limitation of this study is that our estimates may be conservative about the number of deaths associated with poverty. The onset of the coronavirus pandemic in 2020 brought about a sharp increase in U.S. poverty as millions of people got sick, were thrown out of work, and lost health insurance. But federal aid initiatives enacted in response to the public health and economic crisis, from stimulus checks to boosted unemployment benefits to enhanced nutrition assistance, ultimately led to a significant drop in poverty, further bolstering the case that poverty is a policy choice. However, many of those poverty-reducing aid programs, including the Enhanced Child Tax Credit that sharply slashed poverty among kids in the U.S., have since lapsed or been terminated, threatening to reverse any recent progress. Brady said in a statement that if the U.S. had less poverty, there would be a lot better health and well-being. People could work more and they could be more productive. He added, of all of these, there are benefits of investing in people through social policies. Also, according to the U.S. News, poverty is the fourth greatest cause of death in the United States, according to a new research. Researchers at the University of California, Riverside, estimate that poverty was associated with 183,000 deaths in 2019 among people 15 years old and older. And that's a conservative estimate, they say, because the year was just prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. People living in poverty have incomes less than 50% of the U.S. median income. The researchers noted, in 2021, the median household income was $70,784 per household, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Impoverished Americans have roughly the same survival rates as richer folks until they hit their 40s. Then they die at significantly higher rates, according to the study. The analysis found that only heart disease, cancer, and smoking kill more people than poverty. Deaths related to obesity, diabetes, drug overdoses, suicides, firearms, and homicides were all fewer than deaths associated with poverty.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Thank you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Midstream.
March 10, 2023, Saudi Arabia and Iran announced their intention to restore diplomatic relations over a two-month period in a deal brokered by China. Riyadh's reconciliation with Syria is also underway, along with negotiations with Yemen's Ansarullah, which was crowned by the largest prisoner swap yet between both sides. This rapprochement with the Islamic Republic and other regional efforts matter because they shed light on a significant region-wide trend of de-escalation that has been underway since the resumption of high-level UAE-Iran relations in 2019. In the wake of geopolitical tensions and distraction, it also marks a shift towards direct Middle East regional conflict management, which is a first for countries in the region. Driven by a combination of conflict fatigue in Syria, Iraq, and Yemen, a focus on economic security, and continued concern over declining U.S. influence, Saudi Arabia seems to be adamant on engaging in an unprecedented pattern of reconciliation to protect its interests and achieve its 2030 vision amid fluctuations in the world order. Countries in the region have also realized that confrontation with Iran and its allies in the axis of resistance has not only failed to deliver the desired results, but has also exposed them to economic vulnerabilities. For the UAE and Saudi Arabia in particular, the June 2019 Yemeni attacks on two oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman and the September 2019 attacks on Saudi Arabia's Aramco oil infrastructure caused a change in thinking. Moreover, multiple failed rounds of regime change attempts and maximum pressure international sanctions have also failed to get Iran to alter its regional posture or reduce support for regional resistance movements, especially in Lebanon, Palestine, and Syria. The rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran marks the formal end of 7 years of heightened tensions and could have important consequences for the Saudi war on Yemen, significantly improving Iran's role in the region and creating regional stability more broadly. Although Yemen is a difficult nut to crack, a significant step toward a long-term truce is being negotiated. Underpinning the ceasefire and dampening down cross-border activity would provide Saudi Arabia with some respite, knowing that by ending its useless adventure in Yemen, its oil infrastructure will remain safe. Bahrain is also expected to follow Riyadh's lead and resume dialogue with Tehran. Elsewhere, the United Arab Emirates has taken the lead in restoring Arab state ties with the Syrian Arab Republic. Although this is a step-by-step process, news that Saudi Arabia's foreign minister landed in Damascus last week to reopen the kingdom's consulate suggests that full normalization with Syria, despite U.S. and EU sanctions, is well underway. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. On March 6, 2023, representatives from Iran and Saudi Arabia met in Beijing for discussions brokered by China. 4 days later, Riyadh and Tehran announced that they will decide to normalize relations. This landmark agreement transformed the Middle East by realigning its major powers, replacing the current Arab-Iranian divide with a complex web of relationships and weaving the region into a new world order free of U.S. hegemony with global ambitions. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Ali Murad, political commentator and journalist at the Lebanese daily Al-Akhbar. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Murad. Now,
continued concern over declining U.S. engagement in the Middle East, and with the increased geopolitical competition in the region, states across the region have engaged in unprecedented patterns of reconciliation. What are the once close allies of the U.S. really afraid of to jump into such reconciliation? I mean, what do they seek to protect with these new détentes with Iran, for example?
Greetings to you and thank you for hosting me. There is no doubt that the behavior of the allies of the United States of America in the region, with the exception of the Israeli entity, has been sensing for some time a change in the way Washington deals with the region's files. For years, the Americans have been declaring a policy of heading towards East Asia, and therefore, the capabilities that the Americans have must be directed to that region. This was a factor of concern for the Arab countries in West Asia, which are classified as allies of the United States of America. In terms of the fact that there will no longer be American security guarantees for these countries, because they are countries that are afraid from the revolutions of their own people, or even from competing with regional powers in West Asia. With regard to Saudi Arabia in particular, it has believed for some time that it is incapable of influencing the U.S. decision to provide it with security guarantees in the region. And we have seen the American project with the conclusion of a peace agreement between Saudi Arabia and the occupying entity in the face of Iran. We saw that this matter was not met with enthusiasm among the Arab countries, especially those bordering the Persian Gulf. That is why we saw desperation in Saudi Arabia that eventually pushed her to treat the cause of the problem, which the Americans were keen to stalk. The problem has always been to intimidate Saudi Arabia and the countries of the region from dialogue with Iran and communication with it, thus blackmailing these countries and pushing them to buy more weapons and keep them in constant need of the Americans. Now, these countries, led by Saudi Arabia, are communicating with Iran and saying that they are in the process of solving problems with the Islamic Republic with the aim of arranging the situation in the region. Because the two parties today, in Tehran and in Riyadh, are talking about the need to benefit from this agreement to the maximum extent possible in order to resolve all the contentious files in the region. This means that there is a decision by the main powers in the region to deal with the problems of the region among themselves, regardless of the American role, influence, or hegemony.
Mm-hmm. Well, a key driver here of this new approach is certainly connected to the regional perceptions of inconsistent U.S. security support for many regional states that were once considered one of the biggest allies of the United States of America. However, the U.S. is still here, has military bases, numerous military bases in the region, namely, for example, the U.S.'s 5th Fleet, which is in Bahrain, which is responsible for combat forces operating right here in the region of West Asia. Will we see the U.S. activating its regional war rooms to push its once close allies back to its fold?
We have seen since before the announcement of the agreement in Beijing on the 10th of last March that there were American attempts to reassure Saudi Arabia, where the Americans sent B-52 bombers to the region and flew them over West Asia. Then they sent a nuclear submarine to the Arabian Sea. Then they exaggerated a lot about the issue of the ship that they claimed was loaded with weapons coming from Iran to Yemen. Even the U.S. Department of Justice issued a statement on the matter on the 31st of last March, in which it talked about the seizure of ammunition of Kalashnikov rifles. Even the American visits intensified, where there are American delegations during this period that make pilgrimages to Saudi Arabia politically, militarily, and security level to try to convince the Saudis that Washington is still committed to the security of Saudi Arabia and the rest of the countries in the region. There is a clear eagerness on the part of the Americans to invest in the same causes as they have done for decades by scaring Saudi Arabia from Iran. They are still insisting on this policy, which was stated in the speech of Barbara Leaf, Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, and also was stated by Jake Sullivan in the statement issued by the White House a few days ago, which spoke of a call that Sullivan made with Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi Crown Prince, in the sense that Washington does not have many tools of persuasion that it has to offer to Saudi Arabia. It only offers old strategies, and in my opinion, it does not tempt the Saudi side much to give up what it is doing. Regarding the issue of the pass, it has paved in dialogue with Iran and understanding with it regionally. And also regarding the issue of China's entry through the two main gates in the region, Saudi Arabia and Iran. It is this issue that worries the Americans, who have declared that they want to cease some tension cooling in the region, but only for a temporary period. They want to ease tensions in the region to serve the goals of escalation with China. Today, China is telling them, through this agreement, that I have come to the West Asian region, that is, the area of historical American influence, especially in the Persian Gulf region, through the two main parties, Tehran and Riyadh. This, therefore, complicates the calculations of the Americans, who are currently living in a state of confusion.
This brings us to a very interesting question, but I just have one more minute for it. Do you think that this would insinuate that the Saudi regime might be next on the U.S. regime change list to punish Mohammed for bin Salman for this audacious step to step away from the U.S.?
Mohammed bin Salman's choice to move towards independence in Saudi Arabia from the American presence or influence could worsen the relationship with the United States. I would like to remind here that there are still U.S. military bases in the region. These military bases can be shut down at any moment at the request of the countries that host them. But I think that the time when Washington will work to use the maximum pressure with its allies may come. However, this may happen when Saudi Arabia takes steps that cross the red lines in Washington's custom. For example, when it starts pricing its oil in currencies other than the U.S. dollar, and this is a taboo for the Americans. Another taboo is nuclear cooperation. Today, there is Chinese-Saudi nuclear cooperation to produce a Saudi nuclear program. If this project reaches an advanced stage, the Americans will use the weapons of sanctions, blockades, and even stop all kinds of cooperations and arm exports, leading to attempts to destabilize Saudi Arabia from within. However, until now, the Americans still believe that moving Saudi Arabia to a scenario of chaos will bring about harm to the former's interests in the region.
It definitely will be a very interesting year to see what the U.S. Still is capable of in the region of West Asia. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Adam Mulad, political commentator and journalist at the Lebanese Al-Akhbar Daily, for joining us to discuss this very new stage in the life of West Asia. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about a man named Pahlavi visiting Israel and saying he represents the Iranian people.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Reza Pahlavi, the son of ousted Shah of Iran, arrived in Israel last week on a trip that showed Israeli embrace of a figure who is seeking a regime change in his own country. Pahlavi, who arrived in Israel with his wife, met with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and upon arrival, Pahlavi said he is committed to work for peace with Israel. No idea who actually delegated that job to him, but for sure it wasn't the Iranian people. More details in this following report.
Reza Pahlavi, the son of the ousted Iranian Shah, who has been living in exile since 1979 and lives in the United States of America, arrived last week in Tel Aviv on a visit that is the first of its kind to the Israeli entity. Reza Mohammad Pahlavi arrived in occupied Palestine to audaciously participate in the commemoration ceremony for the Jewish Holocaust victims that were held in occupied Al-Quds at the official invitation of Intelligence Affairs Minister Gila Gamliel. Pahlavi seemed to still be a prisoner of the complex of history, to a point that he truly considers himself a Shah and representative of the aspirations of the Iranian people, who before and after the victory of the Islamic Revolution categorically refused to deal with Israel in any way, shape, or form. However, this Pahlavi mishap will be a new confirmation of what the leaders of the Islamic Revolution and some leaders of the resistance have always said to the peoples of the region, that the main problem of Israel and America with Iran is its firm position on the Palestinian cause and its support for the resistance movements. Otherwise, the colonial empire and its Zionist puppet have no problem whatsoever with Iran being the dominant state in the entire region. Interestingly, many American and Israeli media outlets have seriously questioned whether Pahlavi can muster support for his return to power and have also acknowledged that his father had ruled Iran with extravagance and repression, benefiting from a CIA-supported coup in 1953. Before Pahlavi's visit to occupied Palestine, the latter sent a message to Israel via his Twitter account saying, "I am traveling to Israel to deliver a message of friendship from the Iranian people and to engage Israeli water experts on ways to address the regime's abuse of Iran's natural resources. I want the people of Israel to know that the Islamic Republic does not represent the Iranian people. The ancient bond between peoples can be revived for the benefit of both peoples. I will go to Israel to play my part in building towards that brighter future." However, what Pahlavi failed to remind the public was the stages of the Pahlavi family's relationship with the occupation entity. You see, under the rule of his father, the ousted Shah, in 1950, Iran was among the first countries to recognize the occupying entity in the international arena. In 1961, the prime minister of the entity, David Ben-Gurion, visited Iran secretly and met with the prime minister at the time, Ali Amini. So did all the prime ministers of the entity of the 60s, like Levi Eshkol in 1966 and Golda Meir in 1972. The Shah was also visited by many officials in the entity, such as foreign ministers, Israeli army commanders, and heads of the Mossad for intelligence and special missions. The economic relations between them developed greatly, and the Shah continued to sell oil to Israel despite the pressures of the Arab countries after the 1967 Six-Day War. Security relations were also very close between the two parties, but the most prominent was the assistance of the entity to the Shah through the Mossad in establishing the Zafak Intelligence Service, which was famous for its brutal methods in dealing with the revolutionaries and opponents of the Shah. Hence, if anything, Pahlavi's visit to Israel only brought back memories of oppression and brutality to the Iranian people, which they endured under the reign of his father, the ousted Shah.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Tehran is Sitare Sadiki, political commentator and co-host of Twice Told Tales podcast. Thank you very much, Sitare, dear, for being with us. It's such a pleasure for me to have you on the show. Now, Israel and Iran maintained close ties in the 60s and the 70s under the reign of the Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. Today, Israel's only connection to the Islamic Republic is the spies and the agents that it sends to assassinate scientists and Iranian military personnel. What could possibly bring Pahlavi's son to the table inside the Zionist entity at this point in time?
Thank you, Marwa, for having me. Yes, as you said, back in the 60s and 70s, the Mossad and the Iranian, or the Pahlavi, intelligence service, SAVAK, were working together, and this was brokered actually by CIA, and CIA was active in Iran, and they brought the Israeli intelligence services into the country to repel not only any form of resistance in the region, but also to repel the Soviet Union's power and to cut their hands off of Iran and other parts of the region. But It seems that the Pahlavi or the Reza Pahlavi has forgotten how Iranian people ousted in his father, and how his father was hated by Iranian, and why there was actually a popular revolution back in 1979, because Iranians were actually fed up with that monarch. And as I said, like Mossad and Savak, the Iranian intelligence service at that time, worked together to torture Iranian dissidents during Pahlavi, and the documents showing how they worked together and how they tortured Iranians are really horrific, and people just can go and search and see how they actually were trained by Mossad to torture their own compatriots and people of their own country. And now we're seeing Reza Pahlavi coming back to the scene, probably, I would say, because he's looking for new sources of money. It seems like after the rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran, Saudi Arabia has withdrawn some funding sources for Iranian, so-called Iranian oppositions outside Iran. And this is why Pahlavi is looking for, not only Pahlavi, but also probably we're going to see MAK and other so-called oppositions looking for other sources of funding so to stay alive. Because, as you know, their project back from, which started from September to and ended in January with the riots inside Iran, failed. And now, of course, they're not going to sit down, and they're going to look for new ways to meddle into Iranians' affairs, and to wishfully think that they can, in some sort, change the government, the legitimate government that is inside Iran.
Sitari, what was interesting that it was that Pahlavi touted a message of seeking to overthrow Iran's rulers by tweeting, and I quote, "I want the people of Israel to know that the Islamic Republic does not represent the Iranian people." Now, besides that, actually, end quote, besides that actually being laughable, because it is a democratically elected government, but what is he basing his confidence in regime change, given that the U.S. has literally lost most of, if not all, of its influence in West Asia? What is he counting on?
Exactly. Well, I think these people have been so detached from the realities on the ground, and that they do not understand how they're hated by not only Iranians inside Iran and the majority pro-government Iranians, but also there is no consensus among those so-called opposition forces. Like, there is Pahlavi, there is the MAK, there are different factions that are seeking, or they're saying that they seek to overthrow the Iranian government, and they do not agree among themselves either. And this is something I actually read a report by the Israeli intelligence services doing some sort of calculations, which I would call miscalculations, about what has been happening inside Iran. But there are a few points that I would say I wish the Pahlavi would read about them. And that's the one thing, is that there is no consensus among the opposition. They do not agree on anything, on how to overthrow the government, on who to replace with them. So he is not even popular among the so-called Iranian opposition. So it's amazing how he feels he could have any public support inside Iran. And you can ask Iranians of any political orientations or religious orientation, and they will tell you how they also hated Pahlavi. And they even among those I would say minority that would want a different type of government inside Iran, they do not want Pahlavi back, because they have not forgotten how his father and his grandfather tortured Iranians, killed Iranians, massacred Iranians on the streets when they were protesting. And I think he needs to review the history of what his father and his grandfather did.
I think that's the problem here. I think that Reza Pahlavi is still a prisoner of complex of history, and he considers himself a Shah and a representative of the aspirations of the Iranian people, which people, I have no idea. But these people that he speaks about, they have previously and many times refused to have any kind of normalization with Israel of any shape or form. But for the sake of sanity here, for the sake of discussing this unusual, provocative visit, is there any chance that Pahlavi could muster support inside Iran for his return? I mean, even if in a small amount?
Absolutely not. He's not popular. He, as I said, people here have not forgotten their history. They remember how he and his father, I mean, probably his father mostly and his grandfather, how they toppled the democratically elected government of Mossadegh by the help of CIA, how they tortured Iranians. And no, I don't think there is any chance he could become popular inside Iran, or he could return to Iran, even among those who do not want or who want a change in the political system of Iran. So we see a lot of wishful thinking and miscalculations from his side and the Israeli side, I would say. And I think from the way he was treated by the Israelis, you could say that they're actually not really counting on him either.
They don't believe him either, really. Well,
exactly.
That's coming from an Iranian from inside the Islamic Republic, ladies and gents. I want to thank you very much, Ms. Sitare Sadeqi, political commentator and co-host of Twice Told Tales podcast. You can find her on Twitter, and you can find her on her own podcast as well. I will be sharing along with the video her links. Thank you very much for being with us, Sitare, and hopefully we keep up bringing you, ladies and gents, the latest from the region of West Asia. I want to thank you very much. See you again next week from a new episode from the Middle East Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
Limelight.
Russian Finance Minister Anton Silonov has said EU's short-sighted policy is hurting the bloc more than Moscow. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay with us, please.